the station of the nations, AM 1270, WHLD, Niagara Falls, Buffalo, New York, a Citadel Broadcasting Communications Station.
When I get older, losing my head, many years from now, will you still be sending me a Valentine? Birthday greetings, bottle of wine. If I'd been out till 2:45, would you lock the door? Will you still need me? Will you still feed me when I'm 64?
Good afternoon. It's Monday, October 4th. 2004, and welcome to today's show. This is Dr. Rob Stahl with What Should You Expect at Your Age? And the answer to that question is a lot. And my listeners, especially older adults and caregivers, shouldn't settle for less. Last week, we talked about how local print media, including the monthly publications After 50, Forever Young, and Living Primetime, help to get the word out to older adults and caregivers on how to stay happy and healthy as you get older. On today's show, we will focus on hearing problems, one of the most common and debilitating problems facing seniors today. My guests in the studio are Carrie Klein, audiologist with Diversified Hearing, and Red Rossica, a retired audiologist having been in practice for over 40 years. Welcome, Carrie. Welcome, Red. Can you tell me a little bit about yourselves, your backgrounds, how you became interested in audiology, and what you're doing now? We'll start with Carrie.
I'm a graduate of the University of Buffalo, probably out about 5 years now, and I'm currently working at Diversified Hearing Services. Actually, Red and I were discussing this earlier about how we got interested in audiology, and I'm really not sure at this point. Definitely working with people and helping these people to get over some of the problems that they're having during their lives with hearing and depression and things like that definitely help.
And what's a typical day like for you? Your work day.
None of them are actually typical. I work in 4 different offices. 2 days a week we're seeing pediatrics. 2 days a week we're seeing geriatrics. And then another day, anybody who wants to come in.
And you, Red?
I started working my way through college at St. Mary's School for the Deaf as a freshman. And went into the military for 2 years. And when I came back, I returned to St. Mary's School for the Deaf as a dormitory supervisor. And the more I became involved with deaf children, the more I realized how little I knew about deafness. So I took the teacher training program at St. Mary's, became a certified teacher of the deaf, went on for a graduate degree at the University of Buffalo in special ed, then went out to Northwestern for another degree, and where I met my wife. And we came back to Buffalo, where we were going to stay for 1 year. And 47 years later, I retired from St. Mary's School for the Deaf. During that period, I worked with the Buffalo Otolaryngology, and I taught at Canisius College in the teacher training program preparing teachers of the deaf. So I have a rather diversified background.
And what was your work life like, and what are you doing now?
Well, I retired in 91 from one job, in 95 from Buffalo Otolaryngology, and from Canisius College in 97. I'm now retired, but I'm a consultant to 2 foundations. I'm on the board at St. Mary's School for the Deaf as their chair, board of trustees, and I'm on the board at the Schofield Residence in Kenmore on their advisory committee.
Well, that's wonderful, and I think you've dedicated your life's work to a wonderful thing. We have a lot to cover today, so let's get started. A quick reminder that the phone lines are also open for your calls at 855-6848 for questions about hearing. I also spoke with Dr. Ray Paolini today, an ear, nose, and throat doctor with Buffalo Otolaryngology Group. You'll hear excerpts of that interview throughout the program today, and I want to start with one of those excerpts about how we hear.
Yes, cochlear implants are really reserved for people who are deaf. I mean, these are people that simply cannot hear. We have, you know, medical criteria where...
Can you go through that? Just how do we hear? How does sound get from the outside into our brain so we can hear someone?
Well, sound is a wave. So all sound and noise starts out as a wave form. The wave is transported through, in most cases, air, unless you happen to be underwater.
And this is a pressure wave, right? It's pushing the air back and forth, right? And so this is not like a radio wave that's invisible and you really can't feel. This is an actual pressure wave that's pushing the air back and forth.
That's correct. It's a pressure wave which has multiple frequencies within the waves. These are then directed towards the pinna, which is the outer portion of the ear. The pinna collects wave sound. It then enters the external ear canal and hits the tympanic membrane, which is your eardrum. From there, it hits three tiny bones, which take the sound wave, which initially hits your eardrum, and it converts it into a single spot approximately 2 millimeters in diameter. So it takes that entire energy of sound which hits your eardrum, and it reduces it to an area of approximately 1/100th of the size. That then enters your what's called your inner ear. And in the inner ear, you have an organ called a cochlea, which is fluid-filled. And interestingly, the cochlea actually works in many ways like a battery. A car battery, I usually liken it to. And as the sound hits different areas along the snail-like cochlea, it looks like a snail actually, it's all coiled up on itself. Depending on where the sound frequency hits within the cochlea, channels are opened in this fluid-filled cochlea which cause a nerve stimuli. And then that nerve stimuli then goes on to the brain. Remember, sound is really created by your brain. That's really what gives you the quality of sound, is the complex interplay within the brain, which can pick up these signals and turn them into something such as a voice or a song.
Well, that was a wonderful explanation by Dr. Paolini, and I wanted to start with that to give us some background as to exactly how we do hear. Why don't you tell me what you see in your patients? Do you find that patients understand what the problems of hearing are and even how hearing works? I guess we can simplify it by talking about the outer ear, the middle ear, and the inner ear, going along with the things Dr. Paolini said. What have you found in your practices?
I find that a large number of individuals, their spouse complains about the other person's hearing or inability to hear. Statements like, well, he never listens to me, or... she'll ask him a question if he's in the living room and she's in the kitchen, and she'll say, bring me in the newspaper, and he brings in a rocker. You know, he hears, but he doesn't understand what he hears.
So people generally aren't approaching you and saying, I think doctor or Ms. Audiologist, I think my husband has a problem with his middle ear. That's generally not how you're approached.
Absolutely not. Most people come in not knowing that there's a problem at all. Typically, they come in with a family member who's saying that there's a problem.
And what do you do?
Well, primarily, it's our job to convince them of that. And by doing a complete hearing evaluation on them, we can show them on paper what they're hearing and what they're not hearing, primarily.
Now, I think the parallel, hearing problems generally develop quite slowly. And I know when I was in grade school, I didn't know that I needed glasses. And that's because my vision had gotten worse gradually until I had trouble seeing the blackboard, and that brought me to the doctor for an eye exam. And lo and behold, with my glasses, a whole new world opened up. And is it similar with hearing problems?
I think really it is very similar. A lot of these people come in and they, well, some of them know that they're having problems, but most of them, they're still in denial. And they're just waiting for someone to tell them that there is something that they can do about it. There is something that can make it better. And we're the ones to tell them that.
Well, they probably have the feeling that many older people have, that what do you expect at my age? And the hearing and everything else goes at my age, so I'm going to ignore it and just hope it doesn't get too bad.
One of the things that I've noticed, a large number of individuals will say, he turns on the television so loud that you can hear it three blocks away. And we'll ask the individual to turn it down, and then he'll say, now I can't hear. To convince someone to have something done about their hearing is sometimes very, very difficult, and it can be a very touchy situation. If an individual has a hearing problem, the best thing to do is to have a doctor check his outer ear before he does anything at all about a hearing aid.
And that's where we get into things like wax problems.
Cerumen or wax in the ear canal. And when I had graduate students, I would always tell them that the rule that they should never forget is that you put nothing smaller than your elbow in your ear.
Well, let's hear from Dr. Paolini again, talking about why we should never use a Q-tip. And that's track 8, Jimmy.
Well, first of all, don't use Q-tips, okay? I mean, we should have that planted in every room of our office here. And I joke with patients, I say, go ahead and use Q-tips, it's going to put my kids through college, because invariably they get themselves into trouble. What happens when you use a Q-tip is that you see a small amount of wax on the Q-tip, and then you think, oh, I'm actually doing some good. But what you're really doing is pushing 90% of the wax deeper into the ear canal, or it can cause you some real problems. So that should never be used by patients to remove wax.
At most, you can use it to clean your ear low, but never down the
external portion there, right. Yeah, but never go into the canal with a Q-tip.
Well, you probably echo his sentiments, and you said it, Red, nothing bigger than your elbow, right?
Absolutely.
Or nothing smaller than your elbow. That's the way it goes.
I recall one incident where we had an engineer who was a very popular engineer at a local company. He was shaving one morning, and the door was closed to his bathroom, and he happened to have a Q-tip after he shaved. He was cleaning his ear out, and while he had the Q-tip in the ear canal, his little four-year-old came rushing in to see Daddy shave, and the door opened and hit the engineer's elbow and pierced the eardrum. And he was doctoring for about a year after that with a severe middle ear infection caused by that ruptured eardrum caused by a Q-tip.
I know people also that have gotten the tips of Q-tips left in the ear canal, causing a severe infection and a lot of pain in the ear canal itself. And also hearing problems. Lo and behold, how come I can't hear all of a sudden? I was cleaning my ears out with the Q-tip. There shouldn't be a problem. So that's the advice on the Q-tip. Now, you mentioned two of the most common, one of the most common issues is wax in the ear. We're also going to talk about presbycusis, which is basically old hearing, is what it means from the Latin. How do people know if they have a hearing problem? You mentioned other people observing it. There's also an assessment called the Hearing Handicap Inventory. And what are some of the items on that? It's a piece of paper, basically, that you can go through certain questions, and it helps doctors, audiologists, and even patients can do it for themselves to help convince them that hearing might be an issue. I have it available in the self-assessment booklet that I send out to my new patients, and also the same booklet that if you call the station or email me, I'd be happy to send. So what are some of the things on that hearing handicap inventory besides that my wife screams at me because I'm not paying attention to her?
The hearing handicap inventory is basically a list of items that people, situations that people get themselves into where they can't hear. Things that are on that list are, do you have difficulty hearing in group situations? Do you have difficulty hearing on the telephone? Do you have difficulty hearing one-on-one?
Right.
As you answer each of those things, you basically make a score for yourself, and then it'll rate about what your hearing loss is for you.
Well, let's... Those are important things to remember, that it's really very straightforward. If you're losing touch with the world, it doesn't mean that dementia is setting in all of a sudden. And often people with hearing problems are looked at by others as if they are developing dementia, Alzheimer's disease. And I'll tell a quick story. I had a patient, a new patient, that came into a nursing home of mine, not my nursing home, but where I was medical director and the doctor there. And the history I got from the son was that she had not spoken for a year, and this was felt to be from dementia. So I examined her, did the complete initial examination, and tried talking to her, and she didn't say anything to me. And I look in her ears, and lo and behold, they're filled to the top completely with wax. And I think it was probably 50, 60 years worth of wax that was in there. I was able to get it out right then and there, and I talked to her. I said, how are you today, ma'am? And she whispers, I'm okay. And lo and behold, the woman spoke after a year of not speaking. I called the son, and I said that, mentioned this to the son, and he was equally surprised. Have you had experiences like that? Maybe not quite as dramatic, but what do you find, and how common is bad wax in the ear a problem?
One of the things that we found when I was with the Buffalo Laryngology is people would find a discharge from their ears, and they would think, well, that's ear wax, so I have to remove it. Any discharge, especially if the discharge has a foul odor to it, that could be an indication of many, many things that could go wrong in the middle ear. And you could have a fistula or a growth in the middle ear and not even be aware of it, and all you're noticing is moisture in your outer ear canal. And whenever, if you find any kind of discharge from your ear, don't try to treat it with a Q-tip. As Dr. Paolini said, go to an ear specialist and have them check the ear out. That could be very dramatic.
Now, Carrie, how about you? How often do you encounter wax as a problem and other things that, that might cause drainage, like Red was mentioning?
Very, very frequently, especially in facilities where we go to see the older population. They're putting hearing aids in their ears every single day, and nobody's ever really checking for wax for them. They have no idea. They keep saying that their hearing aids are getting weaker and weaker, when in all actuality, their hearing aids are just fine. They need to have the wax taken out.
And, it could be a shame that they just get a new hearing aid, and lo and behold, that doesn't work either. Let's hear from Dr. Paolini again, and he's going to be talking about wax and presbycusis.
Dr. Stahl, we see two major problems, I would say, constitute about 85% of the problems in the elderly. First and foremost are wax issues. Wax becomes more of a problem in the elderly for two reasons. The first is that the wax tends to get drier. And as the wax gets drier, it is more difficult for it to become extruded from the ear canal. The second reason is that the ear canal tends to decrease in caliber as patients get older, again, making the wax more difficult to extrude. So we tend to see a lot of patients who come in for ear removal, the wax removal. We have a nice machine that washes that out. And obviously, the most common cause that we see the elderly is for hearing loss. Okay, presbycusis is the medical term for high frequency hearing loss, which is characteristic of the types of hearing problems the elderly get as they get older. This is the natural loss of hearing in the higher frequencies, which is seen, and usually by about the 7th to 8th decade, this becomes more apparent. Now, if you have patients who have worked at Bethlehem Steel all their lives or at the Chevy plant, of course, the hearing loss is going to be much worse in the higher frequencies. And this is what we see. Characteristically, they'll complain that they cannot hear their friends or family when there's background noise. If they go to a restaurant, they're having trouble picking up certain phrases or whatnot, and they find that they have to stare directly at a person in order for them to understand what's being said.
So when they are turned a little bit and not looking at a person, they may not react to that.
Right. They need visual cues from their voice to pick up certain words when there's background noise.
Well, let's continue on that theme. How do we, how do you do an evaluation to determine exactly what is causing a hearing problem?
Before we go into that, I'd like to mention that something should be said about hearing conservation, how we can protect our ears.
Well, I did want to get into prevention, so that's very important. Let's do that then.
One of the sports that is notorious for creating a hearing loss before your time, Dr. Paolini mentioned presbycusis, which is kind of an outmoded term, actually.
What do we call it now?
Loss of hearing.
Loss of hearing.
Because when you're mentioning presbycusis and it's associated with age, people are a little reticent to say, well, I'm getting older, but, you know, there's nothing wrong with me, or I may have a slight hearing loss, but don't put a fancy term to it.
So we'll take away presbycusis and just call it loss of hearing in older adults.
Right.
Okay.
But people who do skeet shooting especially do an awful lot of damage to their ears. And they'll say, I have a very dear friend of mine who's a skeet shooter, and he says, well, I always wear ear protection. There have been studies made at several universities, including University of Buffalo, where ear protectors don't give you complete coverage or complete protection against your hearing loss. There's a certain amount of sound that gets through the best ear protectors in the world. The best thing to do is to play checkers instead of shoot skeet if you want to preserve your hearing. And one of the other things that I've noticed with older patients, they'll say, well, I hear better if I can watch your lips. And that's a definite clue that they do have a hearing loss and aren't even aware of it.
Well, what about the baby boomers that were exposed to loud music, all those rock concerts?
Absolutely. One of the most notorious causes of hearing loss are the boom boxes that you see young people carrying around next to their ear, or somebody driving in a souped-up car with the windows down, and you can hear the music five blocks away. There is irreparable damage being done to the ears because of that loud noise.
And with the Sony Walkmans, see that too, Carrie?
Absolutely. I'm not so sure that the Sony Walkmans are doing it quite as much as the boomboxes next to
the loud disco music of the late 60s and 70s, right?
Absolutely.
Okay, well, let's continue on the evaluation. How do you evaluate? I know you have different equipment that you use to do a comprehensive evaluation that gives actual numbers that mean something in terms of what kind of help a person might need.
Well, I think what you're referring to then is the audiometric evaluation.
Well, let's do it in order of how you actually do an evaluation. Presumably, you do a history.
Absolutely.
And the physical exam.
The history is typically the most important. That's where we find a lot of information, both from the patient themselves and from the family members. And from that point, the first thing we want to do is take a look in their ears, make sure that there's no cerumen in there, make sure there's no foreign bodies in
no
the ear.
No stubs of Q-tips in there, right?
We've all seen that at one time or another, absolutely. After that, after we make sure that there's no foreign bodies in the ear or anything that we don't normally want to see in there, we're going to go on to something called a mittens. And a mittens test basically makes sure that the ear is healthy. There's no perforations in the eardrum, no fluid behind the middle ear system. That basically will tell us that everything is nice and healthy.
And what does that involve?
It's basically just a pressure test. It doesn't feel any different than being on an airplane.
So do you put something in the ear, like an otoscope, like what a doctor
uses? A rubber tip.
It's just a rubber tip. Mm-hmm.
Okay.
And you just put that up to the ear, and you feel a little bit of pressure. You hear some tones. That's about it for that test. It's very short. It usually only takes 30 seconds or less for each ear.
Okay. And then from there?
And then from there, we'll move on to the audiometric test. The individual will be placed in a soundproof room, or at least a sound-treated room, where they'll be put under headphones. They will be given a series of tones. At each tone that they hear, they'll be instructed to either push a button or to raise their hand. And basically what we're looking for is the very lowest sound that that individual is able to hear.
At different frequencies, correct?
At several different frequencies.
Right.
And that'll give us a difference of what the person is actually able to hear and how they're making sense out of speech frequencies.
There's also another test that's used on newborn infants called otoemittance. There's the human cochlea has the ability to send out certain sounds through the ear canal that can be picked up by this machine. And by identifying the type of response you get, you can identify a profoundly deaf child or one with normal hearing.
What about people that have dementia that can't follow instructions in doing the audiometric test? Is there an automated device that can give you the profile of what their hearing problem is? And how do you differentiate whether dementia is their problem or hearing problems is their problem?
There are other tests that you can use that are a little bit more advanced, but in those situations there are other techniques that you can use. Actually, just seeing if you can get them to speak to you at different levels on the audiometer will really help to find out the threshold of hearing for that particular individual. Even asking them questions as simple as, what's your favorite ice cream? If they can answer any type of ice cream, you know that they've heard you.
Right. Well, let's go to a short break, and we'll come back and continue our discussion. We also have a special guest, well, your special guest, certainly, but we have Dr. Diaz-Ordaz, who hopefully will be able to drop by the studio today to talk about cochlear implant surgery, and we'll be right back.
Lonely.
We're back now with today's show about hearing problems as we get older. If you would like to call and ask me or one of my guests a question, please do. And the phone number again is 855-6848. Let's get into what we can do about hearing problems that have been detected. And first we'll go to Dr. Paolini talking about how to get wax out of your ear.
Now, over the counter, there are what are described as ear softening wax, such as Ceruminex. These can help. But to be honest with you, the best way is to get a bulb syringe. And you can actually buy them as regular kits, actually, that you can buy in the drugstore. It's a simple bulb syringe with a pointy tip, and you want to use warm water, approximately body temperature if you can, when you're in the bath or when you're in the shower, because you're going to make a mess probably if you're not in the bath or tub. Get a small basin and irrigate out your ears. That's the best way to clean your the wax out of your ears. Just make sure, though, that you don't have a history of a hole in your eardrum or that you don't have any major ear surgery, because then, of course, if you enter water into your middle ear, that could cause infection.
Is there any danger of puncturing your eardrum doing this?
I suppose there's danger, yeah. It's unlikely. If you have not had a history of hole in your eardrum or if you've not had ear surgery, the danger is low. Because the pressures that you generate with a simple bulb syringe are not sufficient in the majority of cases to cause any damage. But you know, a lot of patients either can't do this or don't want to do this, and that's, you know, we see a lot of these patients for ear cleaning. So if you cannot do it for whatever reason and you suspect you have wax, you should see either your primary care physician or an ENT physician.
I know there are some very nice gadgets that make it fairly easy to get wax out of the ears in the office, an audiologist's office, or a primary care doctor's office if they have the proper equipment. But I understand we have a phone call, so let's take that call. Hello, you're on the air.
Hello, Dr. Stoll. I'm Joe. And
yes.
I am 81 years old and have hearing loss. I am using hearing aids that were provided by Miracle Ear, but I've also been evaluated by the UB Speech and Hearing Clinic, and they said I have the correct kind of hearing aids. They are not perfect. I can hear much better than without, but I did have to retire from my teaching position because I do not hear students adequately. I'm fine with one or two people, but in a crowded dining room, for instance, or in a party situation, it's very difficult. I was told there is no perfect hearing aid, and you will have to put up with this. Is that correct?
Well, I'm going to let my experts start to answer your question. This is a woman who has hearing aids, has been told that they're the right ones for her, but she still doesn't hear the way she wants to hear. So how would you approach that?
I think with the use of a hearing aid, when you're beginning to use a hearing aid, you should do so in very small periods of time, one day at a time. Wear it for a couple of hours the first day and then increase the time. And take it into situations where you have easy listening. For example, on a one-to-one basis in a quiet living room. But if you take a new hearing aid into a movie house, for example, and somebody next to you is eating popcorn and the person in front of you is reading the morning paper and there's all this noise that's picked up by the hearing aid, it's extremely confusing to the hearing aid wearer. So the best thing to do is to take it in small steps and realize that, as you said, a hearing aid is not perfect, but there are situations that you should avoid when you have a hearing aid, because it's almost impossible to go to a movie that's very loud and you're in an environment where there's a lot of acoustic noise around you to follow what's on the movie screen.
Carrie, do you have anything to add?
I agree with Red. There are certain situations that you do have to remove yourself from And there really is no perfect hearing aid. A lot of people do complain about noises, especially background noises around them, and that they can't get rid of all of those with the hearing aid. A hearing aid is not designed to do that. It's designed to pick up everything around you. What you have to remember is you have to retrain yourself as to what noises you actually suppress and what you want to pay attention to. And until you can get used to all those background noises again, the hearing aid isn't going to help you in any of those situations where you do have a lot of background noise.
Now, is your hearing aid one in which that's called a digital hearing aid?
Yes, it is a digital, and as for starting slowly, of course I did that, but I've had this for 4 years, so I'm not a beginner, and avoiding difficult situation is impossible. I live in a retirement community where we eat in a very noisy dining room, and at least a third of the population here has some hearing loss, so they compensate by speaking loudly, which doesn't help the situation.
And then everyone's talking loudly,
everyone
and you can hear it. That's right.
Everyone talks at once. You cannot avoid the dining room, otherwise you get nothing to eat.
Well, let's. I just want to hear from Dr. Paolini. I talked to him earlier about digital hearing aids, just so people understand what a digital hearing aid is. And that'll
they are
be
very expensive.
Okay, well, stay on the line because I want to continue this conversation, and we're going to have Jimmy play track three.
Thank you.
Okay.
Now, what advantages would a digital hearing aid have for someone?
Well, what's advantageous about a digital hearing aid is that when most people lose their hearing, they don't lose it across all of the frequency spectrum, okay? So most people lose it in the higher frequencies. With a digital hearing aid, you can use a computer to program the hearing aid to amplify only specific frequencies. This is important because, you know, a lot of the people who we see who had hearing aids years ago, they complain that something sounds too loud to them. And that's because they did not have the advantage of a digital hearing aid where they could essentially not amplify low frequency and then amplify the frequency that they need, and they can do it exact with a digital hearing aid using a computer.
And exact meaning matching it to the frequency loss that's found when you examine a patient.
Right, and this would be shown on the audiogram or the hearing test when they would come in for an examination.
Okay, so we heard from Dr. Paolini. Is there any value to maybe looking at how this hearing aid is programmed? And our caller, are you still there?
Yes, I am here.
Okay, have you had the programming of your hearing aid looked at?
Yes, they did that and plotted a graph and adjusted it for each ear. The ears were actually quite similar.
And when's the last time you had that done?
Oh, about 6 months ago, and they watch it. I have to go there every 3 months.
Okay.
And they adjust it if necessary.
Now, has it gotten...
That's the best they can do.
Okay. Well, why don't you comment on that, about going back for checkups and reprogramming, and also other environmental things that can be done in her living situation, where she lives in a group dining setup, that could help with the problem, not just for her, but for other people that live there.
One of the things that I think we should mention is the fact that when a person says, my hearing aid is not working right, it's uncomfortable in my ear, it could mean that the ear mold is not fitting properly. And if you have full confidence in the audiologist that you're working with, a check on the ear mold fit sometimes clears up many of the problems.
Carrie, do you have any...
Carrie?
Actually, I was wondering if the caller is still with us. Is she still with
Hello,
us?
Hello, are you still there?
Yes, I heard this about the ear mold, and I had that impression too, and this is why I went to the UB Speech and Hearing Clinic to have that checked out. And they said this hearing aid fits you perfectly.
And when you bought this hearing aid, did they tell you if there was any type of noise suppression in that hearing aid?
I'm sorry, I didn't hear that. Did they do what?
Did they ask, or did they tell you if there was any kind of noise suppression in this hearing aid, this digital hearing aid that you purchased?
Yes, there are three settings.
There are three settings.
Yeah, which is especially designed to suppress external noise. Number one is if you're alone with a person, number two is in your dining room, number three just makes it a bit louder.
Okay. And you're using that.
I have not found that these three settings make that much difference.
And you're using setting two in a noisy situation?
Yeah, and it's loud enough,
okay,
but it's difficult to, I can hear perfectly well, but I can't always understand the words.
And that's exactly what most people say. Is,
yeah, right.
It's not that they can't hear people, it's that they can't understand the words.
Yes, exactly.
And in those situations, you really have to try and make some other accommodations for yourself. One of the really nice things that does help is to try and put your back to the wall. I know you're in a dining situation where there are a lot of people. You should try and get somewhere where you're against maybe a curtain or any type of wall that's going to keep other people from talking behind you. That's going to help to keep down the background noise.
Yeah.
Also, a lot of people actually turn their hearing aids up when they start getting into a noisy situation. What you should be doing is actually turning it down. That's going to turn the noise down. Try and focus on the person that's in front of you, the person that's speaking directly in front of you, not all the people that are talking around
yes,
you.
Yes, right. I only talk to the person next to me.
Right, and trying to keep a focus on that. And also, you know, if your guests are trying to yell because you can't hear them, that makes high-frequency hearing loss even harder to hear. When
yes,
we yell, we have more high frequency.
Right.
And that's why it's often more difficult to hear a woman's voice than it
right,
is a man's.
One Men are much easier for me to understand than women and children are more difficult.
One of the things that people should bear in mind is lighting has a lot to do with your ability to hear. If you're in a very dark room and you lose the ability to read lips, whether you realize it or not, you hear better when you're watching a person.
Yes, I know that.
And
that's why the phone is more difficult.
Yes, extremely more difficult.
And the phone also has a limited frequency range over the telephone as well, so you're not getting the full spectrum of a person's voice over the telephone as well.
There is
yes,
something you can get in your hearing aid, though, that's called a telecoil, and you can have that added to any hearing aid that will actually amplify only the telephone, and it picks up just frequencies from that phone.
Well, thanks for your call. I hope some of that may have helped. I like the idea about having your back to a curtain or a wall, and perhaps
yes,
the facility can also look into ways to dampen general sound. Certainly a big room that may even have echoes in it is going to be very difficult for anyone
yes,
to hear.
Thank
so
you very much.
You're welcome. I want to cover very quickly tinnitus or tinnitus as a complaint that I get from patients, ringing in the ears or just sounds that they hear. And let's go back to Dr. Paolini. This is track 11, talking about tinnitus.
A fairly common entity called tinnitus or tinnitus, maybe you can clarify how to pronounce it for us. Can you tell me something about that?
Yeah, tinnitus or tinnitus, and incidentally, both are accepted pronunciations depending on what part of the country you're from. tinnitus is a subjective sound that a person hears, which actually is not there. It can be a ringing, it can be a buzzing, it can be more or less a white noise, like when you hear static on the radio. All of these are different variations of tinnitus, okay? And the most common cause of tinnitus is hearing loss. And we're not quite sure why this occurs, but for some reason, when people lose hearing, the brain fills in some way with this noise, and it drives people crazy, and we see this all the time.
Maybe it's that the brain always has some background noise, but when you hear things, it drowns it out, so to speak.
Yeah, well, we're not sure, and
huh,
there's new techniques available. It's experimental currently, but there's injections that are being done to the middle ear with a drug called lidocaine, which you're familiar with. I'm sure it's used
sure,
in patients who have heart attacks, who have problems with their heart. and it has been shown to be effective in limiting the intensity of the ringing. There's also electrical stimuli, which is now being done in some centers in the city where they actually put electrodes around the ear, give certain electrical stimuli, and in many cases the intensity of the ringing.
Well, tinnitus is a very difficult issue. It may not directly fall in the domain of audiologists. No doubt you hear complaints from your patients about it. I understand, Reg, you're going to a conference tonight on that exact topic.
At 7 o'clock in Farber Hall at the University of Buffalo.
Well,
Dr. Dick Salvi has brought in a guest who's a specialist on tinnitus or tinnitus. They're both acceptable pronunciations, by the way.
Well, maybe if you could forward me some of the take-home points of that talk, and I can get them up on the website for the show, and people can take a look at that as far as what's the latest in trying to deal with that. We're coming up to the hour in about 15 minutes, and there are a few things that I do want to touch on, and we do have Dr. Diaz-Ordaz that we're going to talk to in a minute. There's an organization called SHUSH. S-H-H-H, Self-Help for the Hard of Hearing. That's a national organization, and there is a local chapter here. Can you tell us something about that organization?
I know it's composed of those who have who are hard of hearing, and they have a very strong state group now. In fact, there's a conference being held, I believe it's in November, in either Albany or Syracuse. And they have several speakers that are going to be discussing the problem of hearing loss.
Yeah, I have an announcement brochure here, October 22nd and 24th, Living with Hearing Loss, and I think it says it's in Westchester.
Okay.
Which is a ways away from here, but you know, those who truly have an interest, it might be worth their while to go. I spoke with a few members of SHUSH over the phone, and I think it's a wonderful organization, probably a good support organization, and an organization that can help people with hearing problems get pointed in the right direction. I'm going to bring in now, yes.
Could I add one point?
Yes, Red, of course you can add one point.
Speaking of tinnitus, there's a tinnitus support group that's very active at the University of Buffalo. And anyone who has tinnitus or has a family member who's afflicted with tinnitus can attend the meeting tonight at 7 o'clock in Farber Hall on the Main Street campus. And Dr. Dick Salvi is a moderator of the tinnitus support group.
And does that meet regularly?
I think they meet once a month.
And Dr. Salvi, how do you spell his name?
S-A-L-V-I.
Okay.
He's director of the hearing, the new Hearing Center for Deafness at the University of Buffalo.
Okay. Before I forget, also, let me just spell Dr. Paolini's name. It's capital P-A-O-L-I-N-I, Dr. Raymond Paolini. And now we have with us Dr. Ernesto or Ernest Diaz-Ordaz, an expert in ear, nose, and throat, but specifically in cochlear implants. And why don't you tell us what cochlear implants are and where they might fall in to use in terms of helping an older population specifically?
Well, it will help any population that has profound sensorineural hearing loss. That includes children who are born deaf or any other individual that may have hearing loss that has no benefit from hearing aids. And that's about a clinical type of evaluation you can make.
Now, are you doing cochlear implants in older people, let's say over 70 years old?
The oldest patient I've ever implanted is 88.
88.
And the last few implants, that they were in their 70s.
Now, what was the circumstance with the person that was 88?
Oh, loss of hearing, and she had done well with hearing aids for many years, more than a decade or so, and she lost her hearing and was not getting any benefit from hearing aids. She was unable to communicate with anybody, and she felt completely isolated. Her quality of life was terribly difficult to deal with. I mean, it's like playing charades. You know, not everyone can read your lips, and you can't read everybody's lips. Most people will be able to read other people's lips if it's a familiar person, a brother, a sister, a mother, a father, someone they've dealt with most of their lives. Many other patients are very good because they learn to read lips very, very young. Most older people, I mean, if we suddenly lose our hearing, we have a difficult time.
Now, quickly, what's the procedure like? How long does it take? And are there any contraindications to having it medically?
Well, okay. In the first place, a cochlear implant is different from a hearing aid. A hearing aid is exactly what a hearing aid is. It aids hearing. It's not like corrective lenses. You don't put your glasses on, you see 20/20. You don't put hearing aids on, and you think you can go back to zero decibels. You know, it assists. And that basically, it just amplifies sound. And with digital hearing aids and so forth, there's different ways of amplifying. But a cochlear implant really will take the sound and convert it into electrical impulses and feed it directly into the inner ear, which then crosses over to the inner ear nerves.
So it corrects for the basic problem that occurs in most older people with hearing problems, that it corrects that the hairs conducting the nerve impulse and it recreates those impulses where they've been lost.
Correct. Well, it bypasses the inner hair cells.
Now, what is the sound? Does the sound sound like regular sound when you put this device in?
No, at first it does not. Many people describe it as Darth Vader's voice. Okay, but I have patients now 4 years or more after having had been implanted, and they're able to pick out instruments and bands or orchestras and use the telephone. So it's all very different. They will hear people first, like they're, again, close relatives and friends. And as they get better, they will be able to speak with other people. And everyone is different.
So people are generally satisfied after they get a cochlear implant?
Yeah, most people are satisfied. There's always a failure, and there's always a complication. They're uncommon, but they do happen.
Now, is there a training period after the device is inserted where someone has to get used to how sound now sounds?
Right. Well, it's really more the expectations. I mean, the cochlear implant requires a team approach. It's not only the surgeon, the audiologist, the speech therapist, but it's all those people put together. And the most important thing that we do as a team is to really work on the patient before surgery. You know, it's not a matter of just go, fine, you're going to go to surgery, we're going to do this surgery, it takes about 3 hours, you go home the same day, you take off the bandage, yes, there's a large incision. You know, a month later, they put the external device on, they program it, then you may or may not hear something. Oh, you will hear something, but you may not make what it's saying. Some people do. I mean, some people have lost their hearing within a few months, and you do a cochlear implant, you put the external processor, and they've said, I can hear my voice. And everybody runs out crying because it's such a wonderful thing.
Right.
But no, we always say that it's 6 months. It's 6 months. And actually, the company is saying now we can bring it down to 3 months when they can actually hear quite a bit. It's the impatience, especially young adults who have been very active professionals, or just people who have been very active. They want it on, and they want to hear now.
Right.
They want to go back where they were immediately. And that's difficult.
They expect it to be like LASIK surgery for the eyes, where they can go out and throw their glasses away and see perfectly again.
That's correct. And those are the people that we spend a lot of time with. Because you don't want to put a patient through that. Each implant is $25,000. You don't want it to go to waste. You really want to do what's best for the patient. And that usually trying to get that initial feeling that, yes, I need to work for it. And that's really very important.
Do you usually do one ear or both ears?
We do one. We're starting to do two. But like, it's again, it's double the cost, double the surgery. Some ears you cannot implant both ears. It's a transition period.
And this, I'm sure, is not covered by insurance at this point.
No, it is covered.
It is.
It is considered
even
medically
even
necessary.
Older people.
Yes. There has been no denials.
No.
And we're implanting now as young as 6 months. I've implanted up to 1 year, and now we're going down to 6 months.
Well, and the youngsters, it's certainly very important in terms of language development.
That's correct.
It's critical in the youth. And well, that's fascinating. Why don't you just mention how people can get in touch with you if they want more information? The show is not meant to be advertising or promoting any particular people, but I believe you're the only person in town that is doing the cochlear implants right now.
No, no, there's...
You're not.
No, I'm the only one that's performing in adults, and I do children as well, but Dr. Christopher Poggi at the Children's Hospital does children. Yeah.
Okay, so you're the only one doing it in adults.
Yeah, and you know what, it'll become more common. It's becoming more accessible, and I think as time goes on, I think more and more people will be involved.
Well, you can mention your phone number if you'd like. If you don't want to, that's fine too. It's Dr. Ernesto Diaz-Ordaz, Diaz-Ordaz. I trained actually with his brother. We went through training about the same time. He did GI medicine and I did geriatric medicine.
Oh, really?
So I'm glad you could join us and say a few words about something that's real exciting. Is there anything else on the horizon beyond cochlear implants? Oh, and we should mention that the most famous example of cochlear implant is Rush Limbaugh, who recently had a cochlear implant. But we don't need to spend any more time on him. What's on the horizon?
The horizon, I think that is, it will be bilateral implantation. There's also newer implants coming in with pumps where you can actually submit substances into the inner ear in hopes of either preserving whatever is there. One of the most difficult things you can do with a cochlear implant is use a telephone or actually enjoy music. And unfortunately, that's the one thing everybody misses. You know, well, what do you want to do with this implant? You know, and they all said, we want to talk on the phone and we want to listen to music. And that's tough. You know, what we're doing is putting an electrode into the inner ear proper, and as it goes in, you know, it can easily damage the tissue inside. We're doing it slightly different now. We're making a very small hole, but we've done to 1 millimeter or 1.5 millimeter, depending on the cochlear implant, in a certain area so we can kind of thread the electrode to avoid damage to the inner ear. Now, and it's the lower frequencies that are required for you to really enjoy music. And it helps also with
that bass guitar and the cellos and the other instruments that give that nice soulful wholesome sound to music.
Exactly. And the other one is that they have a little separate channel where now they can infuse substances in hopes of maybe regenerating hair cells.
Now, what about prevention? Are there things that can help preserve your cochlea? We talked about what damages the cochlea over the years. Do vitamins or any, I'm sure there are alternative promotions as to what can help cure anything or prevent anything. Is there anything that really helps in terms of hearing?
Well, they're doing an ongoing study now at the University of Buffalo. Don Henderson and his group, part of the Dick Salby group, in regards to substances that can actually take by tea or something like this. And what they'll do is then expose them to loud noises, such as Marines. They'll give them the substance and they'll go out and, you know, shoot guns. They can't be wearing hearing protection at that time. And they're checking their hearing afterwards.
Well, thank you all. Carrie Klein with Diversified Hearing. Why don't you give the phone number of Diversified Hearing if someone wants to contact you?
Sure. If you need to contact us at Diversified, it's 871-9915.
And Dr. Paolini at Buffalo Otolaryngology, I have that number here somewhere. That number is 883-6800. And Dr. Diaz-Ordaz, do you have a number you want to give to someone? 634-7350. And Red, you happen to be retired, so...
The number is 834-7200.
834-7200 for Red Rosica
at
St. Mary's School for the Deaf. And this is Dr. Rob Stahl. We have email, drstall at whatshouldyouexpect.com. The website is whatshouldyouexpect.com. The station, 855-6848, for any questions you want to call in during the week, and I can address them next week. And next week, we are going to have Dr. Joseph Mylott, an infectious disease specialist, talk about immunizations and infections in older adults. Well, it was a pleasure. Had a great conversation, a lot of good information. And this is Dr. Rob Stahl. We'll see you next week.
We shall talk.